Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And today?
Oh, I don't know. We're talking about... we're in a doubtful state of mind. Constant doubt. That's the topic.
Yes.
Like in the last chapter, we met a person who had a real doubt pileup. He lost his faith in God. He lost his girl.
That's maybe an extreme example of something that we all go through every day, right?
Yeah, I mean...
You wake up.
And then you have to get something done, and then some little voice inside you says, you can't do
so
that.
Not so sure about
not
this,
today.
But still you got to act because you're an adult.
Yes.
So what do you do in that case? How do you act without the feeling of certainty?
Hello.
Hi.
Is this Annie?
Yes.
Okay. And we met someone who thinks about this all the time.
This is an area that I'm pretty well versed in.
Would this be your stock and trade?
This would be very much so.
Her name is Annie Duke.
I'm a decision strategist.
But you might know her better as a badass poker player.
Well, in 2004, I won a bracelet, which is a world championship. I also won the Tournament of Champions that year. That was the...
She has won a lot. Now, when we called up Annie, we had this idea about poker that I think a lot of people have, which is that it's like this game about tells and like reading your opponent, watching the way their nose quivers so that you can tell when they're bluffing or when they've got a good hand.
Nope. Tells are actually a very small part of the game.
In fact, she says, they often backfire.
I remember the first tournament I played after it was on TV. I had a hand that was kind of a close decision, and this guy moved all of his chips in to the pot, and God, he was just confident. Like, I could see, like, he was really confident in his hand, so I threw my hand away.
But then in a subsequent game, she sees the same guy doing exactly the same thing. He pushes all his chips in, looking super confident.
I was like, wow, he must have, like, a crazy hand, like two aces. And he turns his hand over face up, and he's super confident in it. And it was a really bad hand. It was just a hand that he thought was good. So the problem for me was that I read him totally correctly. But what I didn't understand was that he didn't...
He was a dunce.
Let's call him inexperienced.
Okay.
He didn't know what a good hand or a bad hand was.
But then you get players who are a little bit more experienced, and sometimes they would...
Do what's called a reverse tell.
Is that like a double fake?
Right.
They basically pretend to be overconfident, so she'd think they're dumb.
And in the biz, we call that Hollywooding.
So she says, unless you've played someone a million times, it's really hard to know how to read them. And what's worse, the good players, they do nothing.
Doing nothing is the best choice.
But you try to disappear.
You pick a spot on the table, stare at it.
So what do you do in the case where there aren't any signals to read, and the only thing you really know is that you know nothing?
Well... Actually, what you sort of figure out is that you don't need to know. The real breakthrough moment for me was when I stopped trying to figure out anything with certainty.
And here Annie laid out a way of thinking, a way of taming doubt that we find completely fascinating and that has paid off for her to the tune of about $4 million.
Well, you know, I think that...
Do you mind if we just back up?
Okay.
Like, how did you get to be Annie Duke?
Well, I was born Annie Letterer, and then I married someone with the last name Duke and thought, that's much easier.
I mean, Annie Duke.
Well, I went to Columbia undergrad, double major in English Literature and Psychology.
Ah, psychology. There we go.
Then I went to UPenn, studied cognitive psychology there. I had a National Science Foundation fellowship. And then right at the end, just really had this realization that I didn't really want to be an academic. Holy hell, like, what am I going to do now?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, I need some money. I'll play some poker while I'm figuring it out.
And had you played a lot of poker to that point?
No, but I'd watch my brother play a lot.
Well, she would come out and she would sit behind and watch.
That's Annie's brother.
This is Howard. Howard Letterer.
Sounds exactly like his sister, but with a deeper voice.
He started mentoring me.
A little bit.
And I started making money right away.
She was very competitive.
Was your mother tearing out her hair at this point, or was she agreeing
with
him?
Well, at that point, my parents had just given up hope.
Yeah.
My brother, when he was 18, my grandfather
had cut the family a $2,000 check.
For the two of us to help with college. Mm-hmm. And, my brother gambled it away in a little poker room in the back room.
Well, that might have been the very early phase. I was a terrible poker player.
So. Howard has since become a very decorated poker player.
And he's also been in the news recently because an online poker company he was associated with called Full Tilt has gotten into some legal difficulties.
But back when he was starting, he says he would play in these tiny little games.
36 hours straight, which was not atypical for me back then.
And it was all very seat of the pants.
But I... I arrived in this wonderful situation.
He was fortunate. He happened to be learning the game, which he would later teach to his sister, at a time, you know, 1983, 1984, when the game
was changing radically.
Look, poker was this Texas gambler thing happening in Vegas.
Like the cliche we just talked about, you know, you play with your gut.
With the Texas Dolly and Amarillo Slim and who knows what's going on over there.
But then, like in so many other things, the geeks took over.
Well, you know, there were these games I was playing in, and I was...
People will peg the change to different times, different places, but for Howard, it began in New York.
Yep.
When he joined this regular game.
A huge game. These are Wall Street traders, world champion bridge players, brilliant people.
They'd get together after Wall Street closed, play for about 8 hours, then go to a bar and carefully deconstruct the 8 hours they just played.
You know, hey, what were you thinking in that? Why did you do that? Why you weren't really bluffing, but you made this big bet.
And out of those conversations came a style of play that you now find everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Hold 'em. Okay, listen. If you Google the phrase right now, hold 'em odds chart, you're going to be able to get it.
Hold 'em.
Hold 'em.
Yeah, hold 'em odds chart.
We ended up talking to our friend Mike about all this.
My name's Mike Pesca. I cover sports for NPR.
And he's also spent a fair amount of time in underground poker clubs.
By the way, it's always a misnomer because in New York City, they're always on the ninth floor of an office building or something like that.
Really? Anyway, he showed us these charts.
Yeah. Okay. And what?
Oh my God! Look at this thing.
What is it?
It's like my nightmare. It's like a spreadsheet with tons and tons of numbers.
Well, first I'll say this.
But Mike says, don't be afraid. These charts, this is how you achieve Zen.
In an uncertain world.
Okay, let me give you a situation. You're playing the game of Hold'em, and there's only one card to come, the river card. That is the last card in Hold'em. And you figure, in fact...
Just to explain, in Texas Hold'em, each player gets two secret cards that they can see, and the dealer puts down a bunch of community cards, one by one, that everyone can see. And the game is, who can combine their secret cards with the community cards to make the best hand?
Exactly.
Now, say one of your secret cards is a heart.
And on the board, the community cards include three hearts.
Okay. I've got one in my hand, that's four. Dealer's about to deal another card.
And if the last card is a heart...
Well, damn, I would have a flush, so I want to know...
What are the odds...
of me getting that last heart?
Every decent poker player will know how to calculate this automatically.
And for the non-decent ones, well, then there's the chart.
You know there are 13 of every suit in the deck. You know there are 13 hearts in the deck.
Right.
And there are three hearts on the board.
One in my hand.
That means that you can figure that there are...
13 minus 3 minus 1.
9 cards in the deck out of the 46 that we don't know about.
That can complete my flush.
Now look at this chart.
All right, I'm
see,
looking at
see
9.
See where the number 9 is?
Yeah.
Go all the way to the right.
Uh-huh. 9, flush, draw, knight.
So when you do the odds, you wind up having about a 20% chance of victory.
Of getting that last heart.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do you do in this circumstance?
My odds are...
Your odds are 20% to win. Do you bet? Do you go for it? Do you stay in? Be bold? Or do you fold?
I... 20%. I fold, I think.
Totally.
I fold.
Of course you fold.
I walk away.
Get out of there.
I quit the game.
Live to fight another day.
Exactly.
No.
No, 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 no.
Nope.
No.
Not necessarily.
Every poker.
And he says there are times when 20-25% sure means bet.
I know that sounds counterintuitive, so let me explain what I mean.
And this is the nut of it right here.
Let's say that someone bets $100 and there's already $200 in the pot. Okay? That means that for you to continue with your hand, you have to put in $100. So if you win the pot, you'll win $300. And if you lose the pot, you'll lose $100, right?
Okay.
In order to break even, you could lose the pot three times because you'd lose $100 three times. So that would be negative 300. And you could win the pot once.
That makes sense.
Right? Because you're going to get 300 and then you would break even.
So you could lose $100 on Monday, $100 on Tuesday. You could lose another 100 on Wednesday. But if you win the 300 back on Thursday, yeah, you're good.
You just need to win one out of every four times.
So that means that you have to win the pot 25% of the time.
Those are your pot odds.
Pot odds are what dictates good bets.
The amount that's in the pot determines how certain you have to be that your hand is good.
Which is a really cool concept, I think. Because if your pot odds are 25%, then all you really need to be is 25% sure that you have a good hand.
Which you are, in the hearts case.
Sometimes you have to be 40% sure. Sometimes you have to be 30% sure. You know, if there's $70 in the pot and you only have to call 10, you know, now you're in the 15% range in terms of how certain you have to be that your hand is good.
In that case, you can bet this hand that you're really not sure about, knowing that while you might lose this time.
If I do that a million times in my poker life, the law of high numbers indicates that I'm going to be very much a winner in the long run. It might be the very long run, but you should be ahead in the long run.
Because it's not about winning the hand all the time. It's about winning the hand enough of the time.
That is what she got watching her brother.
I'm sure that I'm just quoting him.
And that's warm comfort? I mean, that's weird. So the math, the probabilities are what you care about most.
Yeah, because that sort of embracing of uncertainty does some really wonderful things for you. If you're in a situation where you only have to have the best hand 25% of the time, if you're playing well, you're going to have a bad hand a lot of the time. It's okay. It's actually irrelevant.
And that's really the big bonus of this way of thinking. You begin to learn how to avoid that very human tendency to feel
shamed, embarrassed
when you lose. You just float right above it.
If you're making good decisions, then you're making good decisions.
You have to be somewhat outcome blind.
But
sometimes that's not so easy.
No. Case in point.
There is no event on the planet like it.
2004.
The World Series of Poker.
Biggest tournament in all of poker.
What a tournament this is to handle emotionally.
Three people left at the table.
Annie Duke, this guy Phil Hellmuth, who's a big player, and Annie's brother Howard.
They've played together for so long, but never for $2 million, never been in this type of position.
$2 million is on the line.
They get their cards.
And
Annie Duke with sixes.
I had two sixes.
Pretty good hand.
And she'll open with 70,000.
Big, fat opening bet.
Over to Phil.
Phil thinks, no.
Phil Hellmuth immediately gets out of the way again.
He folds.
Over to Howard Lederer.
And here's where things get interesting. Instead of folding like that guy Phil.
My brother moved in on me.
Howard goes all in against his sister.
Uh-oh.
Decision now to Annie with the pocket sixes.
Annie thinks, should I stay in? Should I bail? Well,
mathematically, two sixes actually rates to be the best hand there. So,
brother, it's on.
Yep.
I call.
However, when they turn over their cards, and remember, she has two sixes.
Actually,
he's got a seven, and
it turned out he had two sevens.
Yep.
He gets what he wants, a 4-to-1 favorite.
I see him, Ben.
And Annie knows she's in trouble, her brother in a commanding position.
And he was 82% to win the hand.
They both knew that if they play this hand 100 times, he's going to win about 82 of them.
The only thing that can save her is if the dealer now turns over a six. There's an 18% chance.
And here comes the flop.
Dealer turns over the cards.
Annie gets her six and a full house.
God.
And she immediately feels horrendous for her brother.
And I won the hand.
And that's the end of the line for Howard Lederer. Annie Duke knocks her big brother out.
In the video, you see her getting up from the table.
I'm sorry, Howard.
And she hugs her brother.
Oh, this is very difficult for Annie.
Wow, what a six, Annie.
You see her emotions?
You must have mixed feelings about that, baby.
No, Annie...
Look, I was 82% to win that pot. That was an incredibly unlucky hand for me.
Yeah, that's your but little sister, too.
I've just been like, I taught her how to do that.
Yeah, no, I wanted to win that hand. That's for sure. I was upset.
When my mom watched that, she called me up and she was like in tears. And she was like, how could you knock your brother out of the tournament? And I was like, I know who your favorite is.
Now, here's the thing. If your superior cards do not win the day, you know, we have a vocabulary to deal with that. It's called a bad beat.
A bad beat.
A bad beat is when you had the cards that should have won and you got beat.
Wow, there's a term that should catch on right there.
If, say, in stock investing, you were to say, look, you invested for all the right reasons, but the stock went down because someone you never heard of shorted it. That was a bad beat.
You know what I wonder?
What?
Like, you know, this whole
rigorous, probabilistic way of thinking.
Is that something that you just acquire once you know the math? Or do you have to first be of a certain cast of mind in order to kind of get into it. Well, because I'm not sure it would work for me.
You have to be from a pretty unusual family to know to get consolation from that.
All right, I'll tell you what our family's like. So my brother and my brother-in-law both knew my boyfriend before me and my boyfriend started dating, okay?
Right.
And they, when they found out we were going on a date, they made a market for what the probability was that we would actually end up together.
There is a bet. He was willing to give me $27. If they get married, I have to give him $100. I was offering him 73 to 27.
What is wrong with you?
And I was like, are you insane? We haven't gone on a date together yet.
Exactly. They've never gone on a date yet. I made one of the best bets ever.
But I assume you'd be happy to lose that bet.
I'm gonna be thrilled. But that's how gamblers think. I mean, it's not a bad way or taints anything. It's just that's the way that we memorialize the fact that we had a fundamental difference of opinion.
Okay, so that works. You know, if you're betting on your sister's marital status, I suppose. But like, if it's bigger stakes, like going back to the beginning of the program, where we were concerned with the presence or unpresence of God, that's not a mathematical thing.
Ah, well. I'm not so sure that's true.
Soren, would you like to say something?
Well, there was a guy named Pascal. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
I have.
Who thought that you could do exactly that. So he was one of the first thinkers of probability. So all this stuff we've been talking about. But he, at some point, was also struggling with the question of God, and he couldn't decide for sure. Mm-hmm. He always thought there was a chance that he did exist, a chance he didn't, so he didn't know what to do. So he came up with an idea. He said, if I decide to believe in him, right? In that scenario, if he exists, eternal, forever, happy.
If you believe in him and he happens to be there, then you win the pot.
Big time.
Forever, yeah. Like infinite. Now, if I decide to not believe in God, that's my other option.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm a not believer. If he does exist.
And you don't believe.
Very, very, very infinite bad. Eternal damnation. Forever.
Then you go to hell.
Then you go to hell. So there's a huge infinite payoff to believing in God. And there's an infinite downside to not believing in God.
So the pot odds,
because no matter how unlikely it is that God actually exists, this is like Annie having an infinite amount of money on the table. Yeah. No matter how bad her cards are, how unlikely it is she thinks she'll win, you got to bet. You have to bet.
The pot odds are saying that you must believe in God is what you're is
That's
essentially.
That's what Pascal said. Pascal said, if you do the math the way Annie does the math, believe in God. What are the pot odds on God?
See, but that's ridiculous, by the way. You know, that's ridiculous.
Because you feel like Pascal's faith is lesser. His belief in God because he got to it through math is somehow lesser than, I don't know, say, St. Augustine or someone you respect.
Yes, because we're talking here about grace and love and being connected. And it is a daredevil-y, heart of your hearts, full of emotion, that's what rules here, and that's what guides you. It is not calculating the odds.
I don't know. The odds are looking pretty divine right now.